From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Afrocentricity, a movement challenges the nature of education in a multicultural society.
Ted Koppel said, but Professor Asante, what is wrong with studying Homer, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, and Democritus? I said, and so what is wrong with studying Kulanuk, Ketty, Pepe the First, Kagimli? These were philosophers who lived 2,000 years before the ones you have mentioned. And I didn't quite do him like Mandela did him, but he was visibly shaken.
And the Burmese military arrests hundreds on the eve of a pro-democracy Congress.
I think, first of all, just to institute a legal framework that ensures justice will improve the quality of life in Burma immediately, because the great suffering among the people at the moment, the greatest suffering, are caused by lack of justice and lack of rule of law. This is the first and most obvious step that will have to be taken by any democratic government.
Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. With a critical assist from Republican moderates, Democrats are on a path to victory in the political war over raising the minimum wage. It's a fight most Republicans would just as soon forget, but one likely to echo throughout the fall campaign for control of Congress. A defining moment was how Congressman Martin Frost of Texas, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee chair, put it yesterday when 156 Republicans went on record as opposing any increase in the minimum wage. Frost vowed that come November, the Republican Party generally, and especially those 156 House members, would pay for their mishandling of the minimum wage. That came during a test vote against a straightforward minimum wage increase. The House later approved legislation 281 to 144 to raise the minimum wage by 90 cents an hour. And the Republican National Committee is taking the battle over welfare reform, some call it repeal, to the national airwaves, with a new ad questioning President Clinton's commitment to overhauling the benefits system. The spot, which begins airing nationally today, follows a speech Tuesday from Bob Dole promising a tough love approach to welfare reform. But Clinton, who promised to end welfare as we know it during his 92 campaign, anticipated Dole's move and embraced a reform program instituted by Wisconsin's Republican governor. And this news from Kansas: while looking for Senator Bob Dole's successor, the governor didn't have to go very far to find his leading candidate, Lieutenant Governor Sheila Fromm. Governor Bill Graves scheduled a news conference for today to discuss Dole's successor. The senator leaves office next month to focus on his presidential campaign. Republican sources speaking on condition of anonymity said they understood Fromm had agreed to accept the appointment and would run for election to complete Dole's term, which expires at the end of 1998. If appointed, she would still have to win in Kansas's August 6 Republican primary and the general election in November to serve out the remainder of Dole's term. And April was another expensive month for America's wealthiest would-be, could-be presidents. Steve Forbes sank $3 million into his failed campaign, and Ross Perot spent $1 million to get his third party on the ballot. According to his latest report to the Federal Election Commission, Forbes, who withdrew from the race for the Republican nomination in March, raised his total investment in his campaign to $36.3 million. Perot, the sole donor to the National Perot Reform Committee, gave more than $999,000 in April, pushing his total for 2 months to $1.6 million. The committee filed its first financial report in March. Perot's new reform party is scrambling to get its name on state ballots in time to run a presidential candidate in November. Last week, we played an excerpt of a speech by Malefe Asante, a Temple University professor who developed a concept called Afrocentricity, which challenges Eurocentric public education in America. We received such an overwhelming response to that speech that we decided to bring you a different excerpt today. Malefe Asante's ideas are controversial because he raises some fundamental questions about the nature of democracy in a multicultural society. Some academics have called Asante's Afrocentric theories mythical nonsense. A recent book by Mary Lefkowitz is called Not Out of Africa. But Asante counters that much of Eurocentric history is based in myth, not fact.
In the University of Göttingen in Germany, in the 1700s, two brothers, Wilhelm von Humboldt and Friedrich von Humboldt, designed a system that they call the hierarchy of races, and they developed the notion of the Aryans at the top. These were the so-called, these were the Germans in their mind. The Alpines, people like the French, and the Mediterraneans, people like the Italians and the Greeks. And they said these were the hierarchy. The highest race was the Aryans, the second highest the Alpines, the next Mediterranean, and the Africans, the Asians, somewhere way back down below. That system developed in the 18th century in Germany became the dominant system and structure of knowledge in America. So when it came to America, I'm sure how it came here. It came here in two ways. First, it came to the graduate school at Johns Hopkins. It was a German system. The guy wrote a book called The Greek Tyranny Over Germany. Well, the Greek tyranny over Germany was the same tyranny I told you about in the introduction to this presentation. And that tyranny was that philosophy was Greek. And so the Germans adopted that, and when they said they were Aryans, their problem was they did not go very far back. If you start asking questions like, what was going on in Germany in 2000 BC? You couldn't get an answer. I mean, actually, they couldn't even get an answer from the Greeks in 2000 BC. So let's bring it down a little lower. What was going on in 600 BC in Germany, right? So they couldn't get an answer. So they began to say, okay, well, we got to find us an antiquity. And their antiquity was to skip over the contemporary Greeks, because they didn't like the contemporary Greeks because they thought they were Mediterraneans. And they went back to the philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. They said these were Aryans. And so the Germans connected up to them, leaped over the contemporary Greeks, got the ancient Greeks, and said that's the connection. So this is why people call it the Greek tyranny over Germany. Because what happened was that same thing came to America, and it became the Greek-German tyranny over America. I'm sure how it became the Greek-German tyranny over America. One of the interesting things you've got to understand is that if you take a timeline, 2500 BC, and that's the period when the pyramids were, the 80 great pyramids were finished. They were all up. Africans had already built the 80 great pyramids by 2500 BC. 2,500 years before Jesus Christ, pyramids were up, finished, over, done. Africans have done that. Don't even have to think about that anymore, right? You can move on to other things. You know what I'm saying? Now, in 2500 BC, look at this, though. In 2500 BC, if you ask somebody, what's going on in Greece? Nothing. But the Africans already built the pyramids. Look at this. If it's not going on in Greece, you know it's not going on anywhere else in Europe. So I don't need to get into Britain or Spain or Norway or anything like that, right? Now, but yet, the question has to be, how then did they turn history on its ears and change this situation? So you start with the Greeks. If the Greeks are not, the Greeks are not even in the picture, the Chinese come in the picture, 2500 BC, with the Xia dynasty of China. The Indians come in with 2200 BC and 1800 BC with the Mohenjo-Daro and the Harappan civilizations. We don't get the Greeks. So don't even talk about the Romans, because they're later. When do we get the Greeks? The first voice out of the Greeks is Homer, 800 BC. That's the first intelligent voice out of the Greeks. Divine muse, speak to me of the riotous wrath of Achilles, Peleus' son, of how he caused 10,000 Greeks to lose their souls and their bodies to be eaten by the birds and the dogs. Begin where they quarreled, proud Achilles and Agamemnon, king of men. That's the Iliad. He writes that, right? Now, he writes the Iliad, but look at this. When you start investigating, where did he go to school? In Africa. Just like all the other Greeks. So the question is, how then is it? And I don't know whether any of you saw about maybe 2 years ago now, a year and a half ago, I was on a Ted Koppel Nightline show with Dinesh D'Souza. And Ted Koppel said, but Professor Rasanti, what is wrong with studying Homer, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, and Democritus? I said, and so what is wrong with studying Kununuk, Keti, Pepe the First, Kagimni? These were philosophers who lived 2,000 years before the ones you have mentioned. And I didn't quite do him like Mandela did him, but he was visibly shaken, you know what I'm saying? Because actually he's operating on false information. See, you can't operate on false information when you confront it with correct information. And that's the problem. See, they don't know African information. Nobody, they never had to study it. And in fact, they not only didn't have to study it, they assumed that it didn't exist. So what did African scholars do? We went and studied. And now we come back, they can't even argue. There's no argument. It was a beautiful thing to have seen Arthur Schlesinger trying to debate me. It was a beautiful thing. They got a videotape of it. You really should see that. East Stroudsburg University got a videotape of that. Very interesting, because the position is untenable. You cannot hold a position of white supremacy in a multicultural society. Not only is that untenable, you cannot base your argument on some kind of white exclusivity. It cannot exist. And not only that, you can't even base your argument on the fact that the European culture is the oldest, because it is not the oldest culture. So fundamentally, the 244 years in which Africans were enslaved were years in which we were distanced from our culture and which white people wrote new books. And then made a law that says you couldn't read and you couldn't write. That's a 244 year advantage. And that's why I tell young people, right now we should be reading and writing as much as we can. Because see, we're trying to catch up with that 244 years that they had us enslaved. From can't see in the morning to can't see at night, Africans working for free. Laid the material foundations of this United States of America. If it weren't for the African labor that was free, I believe this country would be a third-rate nation. If they had to pay for all the labor we gained, you think about it. That's why reparations are necessary. You need to think about that. Because you can't even redress the problem. You cannot even redress the problem with affirmative action. It can only be redressed when people confront the fact that in order to have a cohesive society, in order to have a progressive country, in order to have a good government here, the people in this society who have been on the bottom, who have been persecuted, whose labor was stolen from them, we've got to make that right. And the only way you can make that right, as I see it, is reparations. I don't see affirmative action would take 1,000 years. For it to be correct at the rate that people are going. You know what I'm saying? People don't want affirmative action. You know what I'm saying? They don't even want affirmative action. So when you start talking about anything else, you see the problem, you see. In terms of the African-American population and Afrocentricity simply claims that the only chosen people are self-choosing people. You can't be chosen any way else. That's how you get to be a chosen people. And the African-American people of African descent in the United States of America, have often been confused because we have thought that we can somehow distance ourselves from our African origin. You know what I'm saying? Let me put it this way. People say, and I had this happen. I said to a group of students, some of you have heard me say this before because it's true. I had a group of students at Temple. I said to them, all the Italian students, raise your hand. And I had a couple of students raise your hand. I said, all the Vietnamese, raise your hand. I had some students raise your hand. All the Polish students, raise your hand. I had some raise your hand. I said, all the Africans, raise your hand. And nobody raised their hand. This was my class. Mostly Africans. So I said, brother, why you didn't raise your hand? Yo, man, I'm an American. I said, so is the Vietnamese. So is the Italian. There's no contradiction between your citizenship and your origin, your cultural origin. Nobody, there's no problem with that. Your nationality is an American, a United Statesian, actually. I mean, because the brothers and sisters in Brazil, they will raise questions with you when you say you are African American. They would say, well, what do you mean? You have, there's North America, there's South America, you know, people in the Caribbean. I mean, what are you talking about? But this notion, I think goes right in hand with the American notion of this grand concept of taking all the space. You can't take all the space. We don't, and that is what has happened. That's what whites have done. They've taken all space. They say classical music, and they mean white music. They don't mean, there's no other classical music. You don't even, no Japanese classical, no African classical. Not even any American classical, which is jazz. They just say classical, meaning European concert music. Bach, you know, Mozart. But not, so whatever, classical dance, they take that over. Take all the space, cover all the territory. Then say, you can be on the fringes. And I said, no, I don't want to be on fringes. I want to be right in the center. You see? The subject, I don't mind you having your own center. That is correct. It's correct. That's why I talk about it as polycentric. This society is polycentric. Ought to be. But it cannot be the imposition of a particularism, Eurocentricity, on everybody as if it is the only perspective in reality. Let me just raise one other question, because this comes up a lot of times, then I'll be finished. Eurocentricity and Afrocentricity are not counterparts. In other words, you can't say that Afrocentricity is a black version of Eurocentricity. Let me explain why. Eurocentricity, in its normal capacity, is legitimate, because people of European background ought to have a perspective on reality that comes with their reference points. They ought to be able to, their mountains, their concepts, whatever, that ought to be, that's correct. However, Eurocentrism in America has become an ethnocentric view. Now, what is an ethnocentric view? It is when you valorize your particular view, and you make your particular view the only view, and you downgrade everybody else's view. You claim that as Schlesinger claimed, he said, you know, our concept of democracy is what made America great. You know, he just claimed all the territory. I said, you can't claim democracy if we agree that it's a good thing. I said, I challenge you on democracy. Because the founding fathers and James Madison wrote this in the Federalist Papers, number 10. And I told him this. He said, we're not for democracy, because democracy is the tyranny of the majority. I said, now you say you claim democracy? This is one of your founding fathers. He says, he's not for it. So where does the democracy come from? I said, look at the Native Americans. And I said, we still don't know what y'all learned from the Africans. Because they didn't write. They didn't want to write about that, you see. But obviously the Africans came from more developed empires. When Africans were brought here, we were coming here from the remnants of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai, the greatest empires in the world at that time. Most organized. Most highly developed educationally. University of San Kore at Timbuktu was the earliest university, modern university, from a continent with the earliest, most ancient university, the university at Luxor, at Thebes, at Karnak, the Grand Lodge, Osiris. So we were coming with all this, we came with all of this, you see what I'm saying? So when you raise questions about space, they can't take all the space. And we always say, what we were trying to do is to show you what the possibilities are. Stony the road we trod, bitter the chastening rod, felt in the days when hope unborn had died. Yet with a steady beat have not our weary feet brought us to the place for which our parents sighed. We have come over a way that with tears have been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered out of the gloomy past. Till now we stand at last where the bright star, a white gleam of our bright star, is cast. Thank you very much.
Molefe Asante is a professor at Temple University. He's the co-author of African Intellectual Heritage, a new collection of essays, praise songs, and speeches written by Africans and African Americans over the centuries. Coming up in our last segment, Nobel Peace Prize winner and Burmese leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Bridget Ward moved from North Philadelphia to the Bridesburg section of the city, looking for a safer neighborhood for her children. But less than 8 hours after she moved into the white working-class neighborhood, her home was smeared with racist graffiti and ketchup made to look like dried blood. Despite the intervention of Philadelphia police, human relations officials, and even the mayor, Mrs. Ward moved out of Bridesburg 7 weeks later after receiving a letter threatening her and her children. Bridget Ward is no longer doing interviews with the media, but she did speak to ABC's Ted Koppel in an interview broadcast Monday night on Nightline as part of its week-long series, America in Black and White. Koppel also held a mini-town meeting with white Bridesburg residents. We'll now listen to some excerpts from that show. In her interview with Koppel, Bridget Ward describes the threatening letter that was the breaking point that caused her to move.
It was addressed to me.
One letter?
Yeah, I received one letter that was addressed to me and telling me they did not care about anyone, that they would get me. If they couldn't get me, they would get my daughters. I better keep them in the house because they'll get my daughters. They firebombed Thompson Street and they'll firebomb me. We will get you, son, the posse.
You have people that are afraid, and you're asking, what are they afraid of? They're afraid because in this city, and I don't think it has to be this way, but in the city, every neighborhood that wasn't affluent, that became integrated, went downhill, and some have become war zones. People see that. So if you say to them, why does it matter? They'll say, prove to me that we can make Bridesburg stay safe when it's integrated.
I had no problem with Mrs. Ward once one word of her moving in came around to me. Okay. But Bridesburg used to be Philadelphia's best-kept secret, okay? That was taken away from us by a media barrage, which I feel that she had caused, all right? Because of the hype that the media had caused in Bridesburg, I don't feel how I could welcome her, given her contribution to our community. I find it hard to welcome her, okay? Plus, recent events or recent information that came to light, like she skipped out on a previous landlord and such, all right, that basically speaks for her character.
We're going into my back history. Mm-hmm. That is not the issue here. The issue is racism. We're going to let my back history of rent and me paying this and paying that, this is a racial thing. This is not about who I owe, because everybody owes somebody. Everybody owes somebody. I'm 32 years old. I'm going to owe somebody else before I pass away. Bottom line, all I wanted to do was to live in a house. I did not leave from North Philly to come and join in thinking I was uppity than nobody else, okay? Bottom line, I was looking for a nice house.
What I'm hearing from you is fear. Yep. So what I'm talking about, I'm not just making it up out of whole cloth, right? I mean, the notion that...
you're not making it up. Okay, they had a million man march last year in Washington, D.C., okay? They were black men who were concerned about the decline in their communities.
Right.
By moving into a white community and experimenting a little bit is not a solution. It is not a solution, and I will not be comfortable with them coming into my community and experimenting around my investment.
They did not give me a chance to prove myself to them. They didn't know me when they wrote them slurs. They did not know me when they was all hanging out my door saying, nigga move. They did not know me. So now you and everyone else is giving them something to feed off to say why they did not want me there. They never gave me a chance.
And those are excerpts from ABC's Nightline with Ted Koppel this week on the Bridesburg incident. To shed some more light on the Bridget Ward case and housing discrimination issues in general, we're speaking today with Kevin Vaughn. He's director of the Human Relations Commission of the City of Philadelphia. He was heavily involved in the city's response to the threats against Bridget Ward. He's in Jazz FM studios in Philadelphia. We're also joined by Jazz FM's news director, Denise Jones. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, why don't we begin with Kevin Vaughn. Kevin, why don't you tell our listeners a little more about the demographics of the Bridesburg neighborhood?
Okay. And I'll tell you a little bit about that and a few other things about some of the things you heard on the tape earlier. The Bridesburg area, according to the census data, is probably the most solidly unified area in the city. It showed that in that census tract, there were probably more Native Americans than there were African Americans, and I think that showed possibly 6 Native Americans in the entire area. It's a very small neighborhood. It's bounded by a highway, by a cemetery, and by an industrial park. So it's really tucked away outside of most of Philadelphia. It's almost like a peninsula away from the rest of the city.
So we're talking about basically, what, about 6,000 residents, almost all white?
Yes, and in an isolated geographic area.
Now that you've laid this out for us, why don't you respond a little to what we just heard?
Well, and I heard some of the residents talking about housing values and what happens in neighborhoods when minority people move in. And in fact, here at Temple University and at the University of Pennsylvania, 2 independent studies done by researchers show that in neighborhoods that have integrated, regardless of the economic status of the neighborhoods before or after, in neighborhoods that have integrated, the property values rise. That's not to say that if there's flight from one group leaving the neighborhood unintegrated because it then changes into from a white neighborhood to a totally minority neighborhood, a totally black neighborhood, or a totally Hispanic neighborhood, that the property values would not either drop or stay the same because there's not that vitality of lots of different people working to keep the community going. What ends up happening is that when you have an integrated neighborhood in the city of Philadelphia, your property values go up. And it's the same for very wealthy neighborhoods that have integrated, like the Mount Airy section of the city, as it is for working and middle-class neighborhoods like the Olney section of the city of Philadelphia, which has integrated and it has African-Americans, Asian-Americans, and Latinos living very close together street by street and having very much a situation of racial harmony and celebrating diversity on a regular basis.
Kevin and I were talking a little bit before the interview, and he was making this point, and he said that actually he pointed this out in the Nightline taping. However, it was cut out. It was not included in the final broadcast version on Monday night. And I said that is something that's very critical because I would venture to say that if that is the case here in Philadelphia, that would probably be the case in terms of the increasing amount of property values. I would imagine that that would also be the case across the United States, which of course would then, it would seem to me, be an incentive for people to want to integrate their neighborhoods, to want to see a more pluralist sort of picture in the landscape of their communities.
You know, let me follow up on that and ask you, Kevin, what did they include of what you had to say, since that is such an important point and points to solutions?
This week, I think, was an effort to put out what was truly horrific in some situations for people, and to try to get people talking about the dialogue of the chasm between how African Americans and white Americans may see different situations. As you saw with Bridget Ward, for example, you had on one day a group of people saying, this woman should not be getting Section 8 assistance for her housing. This woman should not be allowed to have welfare. We don't want that kind of person living in our neighborhood. And the same group of people who were saying that the next evening were offered the opportunity to be compensated if they were going to suddenly wake up the next day and find that they were irrevocably turned out into African Americans and that they had no other alternative but to live the rest of their lives as African Americans. How could they be compensated for that? And they asked for millions of dollars. There's a price to racism, and even people who say that they are not racist but who have attacked Bridget Ward suddenly realize that they might want some of the money that would help make it easy for them.
But also, let me just add one point to that. Bridget Ward is not the first person to move into the Bridesburg section who is basically there under Section 8 housing.
That's correct.
She is not the first.
The previous
explain Section 8 housing.
Section 8 housing is a government subsidized program which allows people who are living at a certain level below the poverty line to get vouchers from the federal government that will help make up for their ability to get affordable housing in our society. And without it, somebody who is living on welfare and just getting a welfare check probably would not be able to afford to live in any kind of residence. I mean, it would be almost virtually impossible. The person would probably be homeless. And so this is an effort to make sure that families, people with children, and in this case a single mom with two kids, had a roof over her head and the ability to try to get herself together, find a way to get a job and go out and break the cycle. And this is a person, Bridget Ward was a certified nurse's assistant, right, who was looking for employment and who would have loved the opportunity to give up all of the Section 8 certificates and the welfare for her to be able to be employed. She was working to do that. And we're hoping actually that will happen for her.
We're talking with Kevin Vaughn, Executive Director of the Human Relations Commission of the City of Philadelphia, and also Jazz FM's News Director in Philadelphia, Denise Jones. Kevin, let me follow up on this point that Denise raised about the incidents like this in Philadelphia. How many cases like Bridget Ward's are there, both in Bridesburg and overall in Philadelphia, when an African American tries to move into a white neighborhood?
Let me say, first of all, that it's not just African-Americans, it's people who are different. And it happens with people who are gay or lesbian. It may happen to people who are Latinos or Asian-American as well. And sometimes it happens with whites who are trying to move into different neighborhoods. So we respond to all of those types of situations. In 1994, there were 16 intergroup incidents that revolved around housing. In 1995, there were 25. And year-to-date through March of 1996, we had 6 cases, Bridget Ward's being one of them.
Why did this one get so much attention?
Well, that's a question that one needs to ask a lot of the news media, because having worked on all these other cases and knowing that they receive very little attention in the newspapers, I asked that very question. And in fact, the timing of the incident played a large part in it, in that it happened on a Saturday morning when most of the electronic news media don't have too many people on duty. And it was one of those stories that had a visual because it had the ketchup and the graffiti on the porch. And they were able to send a camera person without a reporter to the scene, be able to film the scene itself, and then return to the studio to have somebody do a voiceover on exactly what people were seeing when they showed it on the news that evening. And since it happened on a Saturday morning, it played on Saturday, Sunday, and then by Monday morning, because it had received so much airtime, when the reporters who generally cover the news came back on, they immediately then did a follow-up to Bridesburg and went right to the scene started talking to neighbors.
Did the film also show the Confederate flag being flown by a neighbor next door in reaction to Bridget Ward moving in with her kids?
Yes, it did. And that too, in some ways, was tragic in that there were some neighbors on her street who welcomed her with open arms, and some neighbors in the neighborhood who made sure that on Easter they sent Easter baskets to her kids. She got lots of cards and notes from people asking her to stay. We were preparing actually to put together a Memorial Day barbecue for her and for the neighbors who were supporting her in an effort to try to build some better bridges in that neighborhood. And those people got very little time on the airwaves. And the people who were doing some very outrageous things, like one neighbor who lived in back of her flew a Confederate flag out his back window so that she could, whenever she looked out in her backyard, see this flag. And another neighbor cursed out one of the TV reporters about what he thought should happen, with some fairly inflammatory statements. And those are the images that really got frozen onto film and really set people's mind about the incident, and as opposed to the fact that it was not a one-way thing in this neighborhood, that there was a mixed message there, that there were people who were supporting her and didn't get credit for doing it.
Can you tell us about Mayor Rendell's response? Mayor Rendell, who, like a few places in the United States, was a white mayor who came in following an African American mayor, like here in New York, Giuliani following Dinkins, and Los Angeles as well.
Well, Ed Rendell's been involved in issues around race in the city of Philadelphia since he first came into office as a district attorney. He looked at some of the issues around race and the law and was very active in trying to do outreach to the African American community, even back in 1978 when he was a candidate. And he continued to do that throughout his career, reaching out to people and working with black ministers and with a number of community groups around the neighborhoods over the years. So that he's worked very, very hard and is well known in these communities. His reaction was exactly the kind of reaction that you'd want from an executive person in a city where something like this has happened. It was swift. He sent clear signals to everyone. He met with Bridget Ward to make sure that he reassured her about the kinds of protection she could count on from the city of Philadelphia, making sure that all of the agencies were lined up to do exactly what they needed to do to protect her. He called in the FBI to ask them to help in with the investigation. And then he met with the leadership in the Bridesburg community to express to them his concern about the types of things that he had seen on the media and about the event. I mean, it was, and the thing about it was the type of thing that to him came natural. It wasn't as though he had to sit down for a week or two to say, okay, what do I do? It was Monday morning rolled around and he had the whole thing in his mind about what needed to be done, and he just did it.
Yeah, but you know, there are concerns by residents of Philadelphia, and I suppose this happens across the country in urban areas. But some of the communities that are predominantly African American, income levels are relatively low, experience incredible levels of not only discriminatory practices, but homicides, unsolved homicides. Those cases don't necessarily get the level of attention that the Bridesburg incident has gotten. And particularly, I'm thinking of the situation of women, black women being murdered in a serial sort of situation in the Mantua section of Philadelphia. Very little media attention focused on that. I mean, repeatedly, young African American women are being killed. I suspect that there is an investigation going on, but again, not very much media attention given to that. So, on the one hand, yes, Mayor Rendell did in fact respond to this situation pretty rapidly, and he continues to be concerned about it. But still, what about situations like the Mantua section? What about other places? The level of bigotry that exists in Philadelphia, but not only in Philadelphia, but around the country, is on the rise. It's not on the decrease, you know. So I think that there's certainly more that can be done.
There are many people in the city of Philadelphia who have responses to these events and who work together to try to promote diversity and to work on these issues. We have 45 people on staff at the Commission on Human Relations, which means that in a city of 1.2 million people, you know that we don't do it alone. We do it with a lot of partners.
Sure.
And we do it with community groups, and we do it with the police and the community police policing effort here in Philadelphia. We do it because we have a mandate, but also because we have support from people like Mayor Rendell and people who, like the clergy groups that came forward.
I want to just interrupt to ask you something. I mean, it's hard for you to criticize the city because you work for the city as the executive director of the Human Relations Commission. But I do want to ask, you say that the police was working together with the community and trying to help Bridget Ward. But the police of Philadelphia are hardly a group of people that African Americans can trust very much, especially in light of the latest scandals of, what is it, more than 1,000 false arrests that the police are now combing through African-Americans who were arrested falsely by police. It doesn't sound like this is a group of people, the police, that instill much faith in a group like the African-American community.
Those officers who are involved in that scandal do not represent a majority of the police force of the city of Philadelphia, and I think that one would need to separate them out and think about who they are, what they did, and why we have in this city been able to not only ferret them out, but ferret them out with our own investigation.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Kevin Vaughn, Executive Director of the Human Relations Commission of the City of Philadelphia, and also Denise Jones, Jazz FM's News Director in Philadelphia. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, congressional hearings were held on whether to impose economic sanctions against Burma. This as Burma's military government tries to woo business investors, even as its sweeping crackdown on the opposition and detention of almost 200 democracy activists provoke protests from around the world. Pro-democracy sources said at least 192 members or supporters of the National League for Democracy, or NLD, party have been arrested. Most of those detained are elected representatives of the NLD planning to attend a party congress beginning on Sunday at NLD leader Aung San Suu Kyi's lakeside home, where she was held under house arrest for 6 years until July. Many were seized in their homes in the middle of the night or taken off the streets. Aung San Suu Kyi is the Burmese democracy leader. She is the Nobel Peace Prize winner. And just recently, Dennis Bernstein of Pacifica Station KPFA had a chance to speak with her at her home. Among the questions he asked her is, what is the military afraid of?
One gets the impression that they are afraid of all those who are truly dedicated to the principles of peace and democracy and justice.
Since the military in your country, known as the Slork, seized power in 1988, opium production in your country has doubled. Now more than 60% of the heroin coming into the United States comes from Burma. Are the generals in some way using these profits of increased production to strengthen their hold on power? Are they profiting themselves? And what could the NLD party do to change this troubling situation?
I do not know what the links between the generals and the drug trade is, or drug trade are. That I cannot speak on that because I do not have enough information on the matter. Of course, there are many rumors, but one cannot go by rumors. But as for the National League for Democracy, we are against the proliferation of drugs because we accept that it is harmful not just to our own people, but to peoples from all over the world. And certainly a democratic government would do its best to make sure that the growing of opium is eliminated in this country and that the people who depend on growing opium for their for their life will find other ways of earning a living.
The SLORC claims that their economic program for modernization, building roads and infrastructure, is helping the people and bringing them benefits.
A lot of these roads and bridges and such and railways and such are built through the use of forced labor, and that is causing the people a lot of suffering. And perhaps because these roads and bridges are built with forced labor, by using forced labor, and also perhaps because the materials used are not up to standard, these roads very often because they're not well maintained, they often deteriorate very, very quickly. So what we put into it in the form of human suffering is not worth what comes out of it.
Your country is more and more being compared to the dual society that existed in South Africa. More and more people are getting poorer and poorer. What could the Democracy Party do to make the quality of life better for all people in Burma?
I think, first of all, just to institute a legal framework that ensures justice will improve the quality of life in Burma immediately, because the great suffering among the people at the moment, the greatest sufferings, are caused by lack of justice and lack of rule of law. This is the first and most obvious step that will have to be taken by any democratic government. As soon as there is a sound legal system based on sound principles of justice, the great inequality between different peoples will start to be diminished.
In this regard, have you received support from other great leaders, Nobel laureates like Nelson Mandela and others?
We have actually not asked for their support, but we of course would very much appreciate their moral support as well as their practical help.
Certain U.S. and foreign corporations have taken the moral high ground and refused to do business in Burma until the generals turn over power back to the people. But PepsiCo, makers of Pepsi, say they have taken such a step, yet they still have made their ingredients available to friends of the military in Burma. From your point of view, has Pepsi divested from Burma?
As far as we are concerned, Pepsi has not divested from Burma.
Why do you say that?
Because they are still selling Pepsi Cola here. They are using the ingredients from Pepsi, and they're using the name of Pepsi. So how can Pepsi say that they have nothing to do with the Pepsi that has been sold in Burma, not to mention 7-Up and Miranda, the other two soft drinks sold and produced by the Pepsi company.
So you think this is just sort of a show without a real action, so that they really haven't divested? That's what you're saying?
I don't think they have really divested. We cannot accept that they have really divested.
Companies such as PepsiCo say that as long as the United States does not forbid them from doing business in Burma, they have the right to do so. Do you have any advice on what the U.S. should do about this?
What they are doing is, of course, legally true. But I think, apart from the fact that they should consider the moral implications of investment in Burma now, I think they should also take into consideration the fact that investing in Burma now is not going to be of any benefit to them in more than a very short term, because this conditions in Burma are such that healthy economic development is simply not possible. Unless there is free and fair competition, there can't be healthy economic development. And what we have in Burma now is not an open market economy that allows free and fair competition, but a form of cronyism that makes a few people very, very wealthy.
The SLORC has stated repeatedly that they want a multi-party democracy in Burma. They are committed to this. What steps have they taken in this direction? Have they consulted with you and members of the NLD as to what needs to be done in this regard?
They have certainly not consulted any political groups as to what steps are necessary towards getting democracy, and we are certainly not aware that they have taken any concrete steps towards democratization.
Is the democracy movement or members of the democracy movement getting discouraged? Are people beginning to give up?
No, we are not discouraged, and we have no intention of giving up at all. What happens in a situation like this is that it sorts out those who are truly dedicated and strong from those who are in the cause, because they know that we will eventually succeed. Those who are in the cause because they are looking forward to the fruits of success sometimes cannot run the course.
What would you tell those who need some encouragement, who want to stay with it but feel very discouraged? What kind of hope can you offer to them?
We are confident that our cause will prevail. We are confident that our cause will prevail because that is what the great majority of people in Burma want. And also, what we want is justice and human rights. And because what we want is will benefit all the people of Burma, our cause is bound to win. And for those who get discouraged, I would say they should search their own hearts and find out what kind of world they want for themselves and for their children. And to achieve that kind of a world, to build up that kind of a world in our own country, they have to be prepared to make a few sacrifices.
And finally, do you yourself feel like you're in danger? Have you been threatened? Have you been told that if you keep speaking, you will be in trouble or you might be imprisoned?
I haven't been told anything like that, but of course the official papers are always talking about annihilating our forces, but we don't think about that too much. One has no time to be thinking about such things.
1991 Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, head of the NLD in Burma. She was speaking with Dennis Bernstein at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. She, of course, from her home in Burma. Aung San Suu Kyi, we thank her for that interview. And we're now joined in Washington by Zarni, a University of Wisconsin graduate student with the Free Burma Coalition, which has been using the internet to coordinate national and international grassroots activism and boycotts against the Burmese military regime. Zarni is currently in Washington, D.C., where he and other activists have just begun a fast to draw attention to the plight of members of the Burmese pro-democracy movement. Again, at this count, last count, we have about 192 Burmese pro-democracy activists who have been picked off the streets or from their homes and who are currently imprisoned in Burma. Zarni, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you tell us what you're calling for, why you're fasting in Washington, D.C. now?
Well, first, our first is intended to draw attention to the seriousness of the political situations and human rights situations in Burma. And second, to draw attention to the U.S. Business involvement in perpetuating the political oppression in Burma.
Can you talk about what that U.S. business involvement is? I mean, as the crackdown is happening in Burma now, the Burmese military, the SLORC, is holding a conference calling for investment. And you have yesterday the Banking Committee in Congress holding hearings on deciding whether to call for economic sanctions.
Yeah, ironically, the ARCOR, the U.S. Oil Corporation, just signed a contract with the SLORC, the State Law and Order Restoration Council, Burma's hunter. And they're holding a business. I mean, the SLORC just attended a business conference inviting more foreign investment. And at the Capitol Hill, as you said, Senate Banking Committee just held hearing whether or not to impose economic sanctions against the SLORC.
What are the corporations that are doing business in Burma right now?
Well, firstly, and most visibly, PepsiCo and Unocal, Los Angeles-based oil corporation, ARCO, as I mentioned, Texaco from Texas, and a few other small corporations that are less visible, for instance, like Apple Computer or United Postal Service.
Apple Computer?
Yes. So I'm sure you heard of the City Council resolutions passed within the past year, Berkeley, Madison, Wisconsin, Ann Arbor, Santa Monica, Oakland, San Francisco, particularly the San Francisco one, I'm talking about city council ordinance, which were modeled after South African anti-apartheid ordinances. That San Francisco ordinance specifically bars the city from buying computers from Apple Computer because Apple Computer provides computers to the SLOC.
We've been tracking also the anti-Pepsi movement in this country. It's really taken over or taken hold on college campuses. I believe there was a piece recently in the paper about how Harvard canceled a $200,000 contract with PepsiCo because of student protest.
Right. Yeah, the Free Burma Coalition, which has about 100 colleges and universities and about 20 high schools in this country, we really work hard to get that Harvard rejection. And also, you know, one thing that needs to be mentioned is that about 2,000 students protested against Pepsi's offer to open Taco Bell at the student union at Stanford. And recently, Colgate...
Pepsi owns Taco Bell.
Pepsi owns Taco Bell, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Frito-Lay, 7-Up, Pizza Hut, and all those junk food. And recently, Colgate University, pressured Marriott Food Services because they did not want Pepsi to be served in the dining services. So now, Colgate administration gave in and in turn pressured Marriott. So now they're not having Pepsi on campus.
Zarni, when I was out at the University of Wisconsin speaking, that was when I first met you. And when I came back to New York, I saw this piece profiling you in the Christian Science Monitor talking about how you were doing most of your activism around Burma on the internet. Can you explain to people how you're organizing there?
Well, I have a really cheap laptop computer, but I'm getting a lot of mileage out of it. And particularly, the university provides the internet services, web pages, and all that. And so, a colleague of mine, his name is Alex Turner. He created a web page for us, and I use extensively the email. And I applied for a listserv from the university computer service, and we got now Free Burma listserv, and there are close to 400 subscribers, and a lot of them are connected with different organizations. And so the information that I transmit or people share on the internet simply does not stop on the keyboard, and it just goes into different communities and gets relayed to different groups and families. I mean,
are you communicating with people in Burma?
Not very frequently. The SLOC does not allow any access to any access to internet, but I suspect that the intelligence themselves have access to internet. And so, people who I would be communicating, they simply don't have access to internet within Burma. So probably not yet.
Aung San Suu Kyi says she is still going to hold the Congress on the 6th anniversary of the election of the National League of Democracy, the NLD, this Sunday. Yet almost 200 people, at least at this point, have been arrested. Do you think it's going to go forward?
Oh, absolutely. I think the number of people that are arrested, it's now 210. That's the latest figure. And she's going to go ahead and do it. They have about 390 elected members. And now, with 210 arrests, and they have about 100. But, the most important thing is to know that, this is Aung San Suu Kyi's, show of power. I mean, she's got this much support, in a strictly police state. If she can, pull this, galvanize this many people, what that means is she really does have strong support from the people. She really enjoys the mandate of the people, and that's against the sheer might of the military thugs.
Zarni, we're going to have to wrap up in just a few seconds, but if you could summarize, bringing this closer to home here in the United States, what your demands are as you and your fellow Burmese activists are fasting in Washington.
Well, we're not just fasting in Washington. There are other places like Stanford. There are 10 students of fasting, and UCLA, 12 students. And our demands primarily is that President Clinton to pressure the Congress, or like to to do his job, to impose economic sanctions and call for a worldwide tourism boycott and immediate corporate withdrawal.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us, Czarny, University of Wisconsin graduate student who's currently in Washington coordinating a fast around the country to protest the Burmese crackdown in Burma. You're listening to Democracy Now! Julie Drizin is our producer. She had help from Pat Greenfield and Pat Egan. Special thanks to Grayson Challenger and Paul Wunder. Matthew Finch is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our director. Stay tuned again Monday for another edition of Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.